Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints, and we have two phenomenal authors here of the book, The Last Mrs. Parrish. But before I go into the interview about the book and introduce the authors, let us all say our prayers for the people in Tribeca, and we wish them, we hope that the people that are hurt are survive and get well from their injuries, and we send our sympathies out to the eight families of the eight people that were killed. In Tribeca, it was a senseless, unfortunate terrorist attack by a truck driver that plowed onto the front, riverfront bike path near the World Trade Center. Hopefully, thank God for one policeman that stopped him before it could be very worse. And we send you from Literary Viewpoints and everybody our heartfelt sympathies and hope that it doesn't ever happen again. I would like to introduce the author of a phenomenal novel, of which I will tell you, I posted your 5 stars yesterday on Amazon.
Thank you.
Yes, seriously. Lately, I've been giving a lot of 3.5s and 4s, so this made up for it, yeah. The Last Mrs. Parrish is the collaboration of two sisters, Valerie and Lynn Constantine, and they are here, and I am really glad, and I really wish the sun would shine. It looks like it's going to snow, but it's not, wouldn't dare. Okay, so, the Weather Bureau hasn't gotten it right. We had Hurricane Felipe on Sunday. We had part of it, and that was the joy of life. So, when we're writing a novel as a team, how do you decide the plot line, and who decides, who creates the character? How did you split it up?
Okay. Well, we decide everything together. Initially, before we even begin to write, we talk about what the book is going to be about and who the characters are. So even though at a later point we will split different scenes up or perhaps different perspectives, we're both very much a part of the creation of the characteristics, of the motivations. And, we talk through it so that we know them as though they were, people that we actually knew.
It's important, this is Valerie, it's important for each of us to fully know the character, even if that is not in this novel there are two protagonists, even if it's not the one that we're primarily writing about, although we both contribute to each other's portions, but I have to know that the character that Lynn is primarily writing about, or I cannot make my part sound authentic, so we fully know all of them.
That's fantastic. And the fact that you can do this working together is even more amazing, that working both of each other. I know other people that have tried to do this, and I don't know.
Our mother always told us we had to get along. So.
And it does help to get along, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know. When I wrote my first children's book, my name is Bertha, and my sister read it. She asked me if I came from the same family as she did. Yeah, because what I wrote was the truth. And she said, but Mom never did that to me. I said, that's because she liked you better. What can I say? So, yeah. And we got along, but she said, I really wrote that. So when creating Amber, tell us about Amber and how you created her.
Well, again, we worked together on Amber, and that's one of the wonderful things about collaborating, that you can bounce ideas off each other and build this character from birth till the end of the book and do that together. So Amber is a character who I think everyone has known or certainly has read about or seen in a TV movie, the person who feels that she deserves everything, whether it's something that she's really worked for and gotten on her own. Amber wants someone else's life and feels that that she's entitled to it. So it's that sense of entitlement and greediness, I suppose you could say. And again, I think she's somebody that we've all encountered, whether it's personally or in other novels or in the movies. So we did work on her together.
She's true to life. She's believable. That's what made it even more.
Well, thank you.
There's some people I don't like and know. Yeah, there are a lot of people that enable them. I think they should be enabled. So how did you create Daphne?
Well, the same way. I mean, we talked about both women and how, you know, we figured out the way that they were going to meet and what it was in Daphne that would make her vulnerable to Amber. Because as you've said, you know right away from the onset of the book, we know that Amber has, a nefarious plan. We know that she's not a nice character, but we also understand that, you know, you're in her thoughts a lot and you understand her way of thinking. And so for it to be authentic and to really make sense and for Daphne to still be a likable character, there had to be things in Daphne's past that would make her vulnerable. And it's not giving too much away to say, because it's right in the first chapter, that Daphne lost a sister years ago to cystic fibrosis. And so Amber very cleverly places a magazine that comes out from the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation on her exercise bike at the gym that she's been going to right next to Daphne and makes it look like an accident that it falls over. And so that's her way in to Daphne. And Daphne has been missing this sister and been sort of, you know, emotionally isolated. So to find another person that's also gone through this kind of a grief is an instant bond. And that's how the story moves forward.
Yeah, it was interesting because I felt like when I read the first part that I was listening to Amber and Daphne one way. Then when I got to the second part, it was like two different people. It was like so different.
Well, Fran, you just said that about you and your sister and seeing things differently.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that we did want to portray, that two people can see the same situation quite differently. And hopefully we achieved that.
You did, but we won't tell which one saw it the right way or which one didn't.
Okay.
No spoilers in this interview, people. I have it on my Facebook wall that I'm on air. I don't do chat rooms because only once in 10 years did I ever have a bunch of ridiculously ignorant people that didn't like the fact that I was talking to Jeffrey Wells about his book about the Ivory Coast. And they didn't like the fact that we were talking about elephant tusks and drug whatever. So I just sort of deleted them. And the show is being monitored and recorded by Blog Talk and Radio. They listen to everything. And they happened to listen to my show and thought it was really good. But they said that if it happened again, they would knock them off Blog Talk Radio. But they could always set up another account. So I just don't bother. I just put it on my Facebook wall. So if there are any questions, I'll just direct them. So, yeah, I thought, like I said before, they were like two separate novels. And it seems that part one, Amber's story, is over, and then it goes into a different direction. So how did you come up with the change of direction in the second half?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we knew that's kind of where the twist comes in, and we knew from the beginning, before we started writing, what the twist was going to be, what the beginning was going to be, and what the end was going to be. So, you know, it was just a matter then of going in and writing the scenes and, you know, filling in exactly what was going to happen, you know, to get from point A to point B. But that was something that, you know, we went into the writing knowing how, you know, how we wanted that perspective to change and what that would mean.
Well, Amber meets Daphne, we said, you know, by accident. But Daphne seems so ready to be her friend. How come? I mean, I felt sorry for Daphne in the first half. And I said, okay, why did she want to befriend this person that she didn't know?
Well, because Daphne, you know, is a character with a lot of empathy, and she has a big loss in her life and a void in her life that her sister left. And so Amber is just a master at becoming what someone else needs her to become in order to ingratiate herself into their lives. And, you know, she's younger and appears more vulnerable, and different things happen in the book where she really kind of needs an older sister. And it's just a natural thing for Daphne to open up to her, because she believes that, like I said before, that they've both suffered a similar loss and have this bond that Daphne doesn't have with any of her other friends, especially a lot of the more superficial friendships that she has traveling in the social circles that in which they travel.
And I think Amber has Yeah, Amber zeroed in on this, and I think that that is often true of predators. They know the spot. They know just what to hit. And she knew that this was going to be an area of vulnerability for Daphne, and that this is something that she could prey on. And so it worked both ways. Here's Daphne, this very kind, empathetic, sympathetic woman, caring, and then we have her opposite, who is there as the praying person who is going to take advantage of this very kind and caring woman, and that's exactly what she does. She just zeroes in and knows just what buttons to press.
Yeah, and she doesn't see it. So let's talk about Valerie. My other character, Jackson Parrish. I'm like, this guy's got, definitely has a split personality. That's all I'll say. He sounds like, one day he's one way and one day he's the other. He didn't fool me, by the way. I just knew he was, you know, too good to be true. But he's rich and he's gorgeous. So what
he's a power. He's a powerful man. I think, you know, power,
yeah.
With power, I think, comes some contradictions, and we see that. Look, we're seeing it right now. We're seeing it in big scandals that go on, and so I think when people reach those positions of power, they may be more likely to have a sense of entitlement, and that's all I'll say about Jackson.
Yeah, they think they're immune to everything. I know. He is very controlling. And at times I wondered, you know, I didn't want to say too much about him. I don't like him at all. But he seemed like, you know, Amber viewed him one way, and Daphne seemed to view him another way. He seemed to have a very controlling personality. And like he was one way one day and one day the other day. How did you create that? Because that's what really made him hateful, seriously.
Lynn?
Jackson was an interesting character to create, and when we talked about what he was going to be like, you know, again, we filled in his background, sort of what were some of the things that made him what he was. He is a hugely successful financial person working in New York, living in a Fairfield County suburb, and, you know, he, like many men of his ilk, wants to present a certain image, and we thought it would be interesting as well, you know, again, looking at the two different perspectives. I think it's quite common for anyone looking into the marriage to view a couple one way and their relationship one way and look at actions of, say, of the man and interpret it in a positive light. And, you know, what one woman may look at as being sort of considerate or protective or taking care of, another woman can look at as being smothering. And it just really depends on the relationship and the perspective. So in writing the book, you know, we wanted to make sure that Jackson, whatever he said or did, was true to his character in both parts of the book. The difference comes, again, in the person who's observing it and how they process it and what their perspective is on it. So we hope we tried, and I hope we did, play very fair with the reader. So in going back and looking at anything, it still makes sense, even when you come to the twist and know, you know, things that you didn't know in part one.
Yeah, I know. I got two different perspectives of both of them in both parts. And I said, it was like, oh, my God. And all of a sudden you get enlightened, but we won't tell anybody how. Now, the part I really have to admire about Amber, she's evil, but we don't care. The part I really have to admire her is how she got all the clothes and a makeover. I thought it was really cool. And how does Daphne help her? And then, of course, she makes up the story about her sister, which is a make-believe person. So how does she get her to take her for clothes, invite her for vacations and everything? That was clever. I mean, really, this girl had it going. I mean, really, I'm going to need somebody to give me a makeover and do whatever. Yeah, that would be nice. I mean, I can handle that part. Yeah. I mean, I can just say, that was really cool.
She had her plan from the very beginning. And at the beginning, she deliberately downplayed any kind of attractiveness, made herself very plain and appealing and sort of waifish. And knowing all along that as time went on and she became more enmeshed into the family and closer to Daphne and was around Jackson more, that slowly she was going to begin to emerge as this very attractive woman who, for all intents and purposes, looked like a younger Daphne. So that was her plan from the very beginning of the book.
She was really
She also used Daphne's, you know, as she got to know Daphne better, she was very adept at extracting information from Daphne about what had attracted Jackson to her originally, and really built a picture of what Jackson wanted in a woman. And then she made herself into that woman, you know, again, being a younger version of that same woman. So she, you know, was able to modify whatever she was doing and, you know, use that information to help her in her end game.
And that's what he wanted in anyone. It's amazing that he looked at two people and wound up with two carbon copies. And you would think that he would realize that, but, you know, men are whatever. They want what they want. So, I'm terrible. Daphne invites her. This scene was fantastic, by the way. When she goes to the meeting of the women with cystic fibrosis, and she tells them her story, they don't quite buy it, do they? They don't quite buy it. Especially one person doesn't quite buy it, which I really thought was clever. Because they didn't quite believe anything that she said. So how does Daphne handle that? Because I don't think they really wanted her there.
I think there was just one person who was a little suspicious and decided to keep an eye on her. Daphne had that instant connection because of their mutual sorrow, which she believed was their mutual loss of sisters from the same disease. And I think Daphne felt that there was really no one else in the room on the committee, people working with her in her foundation to raise money for cystic fibrosis research. There really was no one else who could understand, who had the depth of understanding that she believed Amber had. No one else had this same experience. So she discounted any sorts of doubts or questions that any of her friends or any of her people working with her had, and came to Amber's defense, which would be quite logical, I think. I think that would be the feeling for most people in that situation.
And you have to remember as well that they're living in a very upscale town where people have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And Daphne was looking and she was interpreting their disapproval of Amber based on the fact that maybe they were being snobbish or they were looking down at her because of her position. And, you know, Daphne's a very fair-minded person, and that she didn't like that about that. And so that, you know, immediately blinded her to any truth that Meredith, you know, may have seen in Amber, because she really misjudged her reasons for being suspicious.
Well, I could understand that, but this Bishop's Harbor, Connecticut community is kind of like uppity. So a lot of those communities, you're going to come in and you're not going to exactly, if you don't look right or eat the right part or have the right money, I guess that sort of like you don't belong here kind of thing. And here Daphne felt, well, it doesn't really matter. And these communities do exist. I mean, I live in a community that's not that friendly. And moving up from the Bronx, yeah, it took me a while I've been here a few years, and there are some people that are really nice and some people that are very uppity, and you're going to get that no matter where you are. And personally, I don't care. It doesn't really matter. But somebody like Daphne wanted them to accept Amber, and for some reason, not everybody was going to.
Daphne didn't come from that background either. She came from a fairly modest. I mean, certainly she wasn't poor or underprivileged, but she came from a pretty much middle class family. So this was not something. She had no snobbishness in her at all. And again, I don't think that is just because of what her income level had been. I think there are people, no matter how much money they have, who don't have any sort of snobbery, and then there are others who have that, whether they're wealthy or not. It's just it's a matter of personality, I believe.
Yeah, that is so true. That is so true. And you know, growing up and dating someone whose mother was extremely, she wasn't, her family was very rich. And my father, I never talked about his money, and yet she didn't think that my family was rich enough for me to go out with her son. And I really didn't care. Yeah,
that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, she actually told him to break up with me because my family wasn't rich enough. And my father told me something, and I said, you know what? He says, I can match her dollar for dollar. I said, don't bother. I said, because if it's going to cost money to go out with him, it's just not worth it. I said, so he married somebody that actually paid him off to marry her. And I hope they're not happy. So this is really cool. They take her shopping and even on vacations. And how does she try? Tell us about the two children, because one was really smart and astute and sort of, you know, realized something. So how does she try to befriend her kids, of Daphne's kids?
Go ahead, Lynn.
She couldn't stand them, of course, even Tallulah, who was nice, Bella, the younger one, you know, it was kind of bratty, and she says what's on her mind. And Amber, at first, is put off by her and doesn't really do much, but then she kind of sees in Bella a little bit of her own, you know, of her own, in Bella, like that same type of longing for things and wanting. So she tries to kind of bribe her, and she always brings her presents, and she knows that Bella wants to be the center of attention. So even when it's Tallulah's birthday, she remembers to bring a gift also for Bella. And so, I mean, it sort of works, I mean, for a while where Bella is a bit taken in. But, I mean, she also figures once she gets her plans that she'll just kind of dispense with the kids and, you know, send them off to boarding school or whatever. So she just uses material possessions because that's really what she relates to is, you know, acquiring things, and so that's what she does with a younger one. And with Tallulah, she really doesn't bother much to try to do anything because Tallulah's quiet, and she's not so much a threat to the Amber as Bella is.
Yeah, Bella's a cool kid,
yeah.
Though. Yeah. I like her. She sort of had her number, but so let's get back to that super hunk Jackson. How did he make his money, and how does he show that he's not such a very nice person? I reworded that question.
Well, I'm not going to talk about the not nice person part, but he made his money in international real estate. I mean, he came from a family as an only child with a father who was an executive, an insurance executive, and so he always had a good work ethic. He's extremely brilliant and good at networking, and so, you know, he started with a couple partners, and then ultimately just, you know, continued to invest in the right properties and made money until the company was just his.
So we meet, he doesn't like her mother for some reason, Ruth. Now, that's not good. And yet, why did he keep her, Daphne, away from her mother? What was the point? And then before they got married, the father and he was very close to the father and the mother. So what happened that he decided that Ruth wasn't, you know, like a persona non grata anymore? How come she couldn't see her mother, and she wanted her at her child's birthday party, and he didn't really want her there?
Well, again, I think getting into any of that would get into some spoilers, so can't really, you know.
Okay, we'll
skip that.
It's a secret. It's a secret till you read it.
It's a secret.
I know.
Yeah.
My mother's name was Ruth, so she couldn't be a bad person. I'm sorry. My mother was a Ruthie. So Daphne gets sick, and she can't go to a dinner party and the theater. So how does she manage to get ingratiated and go with Jackson? Why does he invite her? And how come Daphne doesn't throw a temper tantrum? I would.
Are you talking about the play? I don't think it was a dinner.
The theater.
Jackson's not interested in taking Amber. Jackson's very disappointed that his wife is ill and can't attend with him. And he, you know, just as a last thought, He asks Amber if she's ever seen a Shakespeare play. She hasn't. She's from a small town. And he takes her with completely the intention of just exposing her to something that might help her, might, you know, give her something that she hadn't had before, but not with any intention of this being a date or being romantically attracted to her. And in fact, when they have dinner together, it's very much as a boss and his employee, and Amber is disappointed actually that he's not taking more of an interest in her. All he talks about is his wife.
Well, at that point, he would. That's all I'll say about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get back to my two kids here. They're very spoiled. And Bella is one, but the part that really got me, well, I mean, Tallulah is smart and Bella is explosive, but she had a reason. Now, as a reading specialist, which I am, her father made her feel bad that she couldn't read. How did you bring that into the story? Because that was really good. I wanted to really smack him in the head because she could read. I think some of her reading problem was because she felt that she couldn't do it, and he was making her feel that she was dumb, and she wasn't. So what made you bring that in about Bella? That was a really good point.
I think that a lot of, probably a lot of people, and more men, not to be, you know, discriminatory, but I think oftentimes when there's a learning disability, you know, there's a tendency to want to minimize it because you don't, you know, parents don't want to face it, and especially high-achieving men want their kids to be, you know, not to be identified having anything wrong with them. And so Jackson didn't want to face that, which made it more difficult, you know, for Bella. And, of course, it creates all kinds of tension. And his motivation was not to make Bella feel stupid, but mistakenly believing that in being hard on her and forcing her to do it, that she would be able to pull herself up by her bootstraps and that he'd ultimately be doing her a favor because, you know, she'd be that much further ahead. And I think it's a struggle. I've seen it. You know, in other with friends, and you know, and different things in the school system. So I think it's just a very common thing. And also, you know, again, having a reason for characters behaving the way that they behave, as opposed to just saying, let's make this bratty child. We want all our characters to be multi-layered and to be, you know, to have authentic motivations that come out in their behaviors, and not to just do things for shock value. So that's how we built Bella.
I know, I felt so bad for her at times that, I mean, everybody has children in the family that have learning disabilities, it doesn't matter. And you're right, a lot of times parents are embarrassed. Oh, my child can't read, I don't know. And then they just sort of put it, I know from personal experience, not from me, from other people, that they just sort of wash it under the rug and figure it's going to go away. It's not like a cold, it's not going to go away unless you address it. And that's what makes it even more difficult for poor Bella, because she's struggling just to feel love from her father.
But he feels as if he is addressing it, as Lynn said, by being stern and just saying, do it, just read. Why can't you do that? And of course, that's not helpful to her. But that is his personality as somebody who himself has achieved. He's reached the pinnacle of success. And I think that is probably a characteristic of someone who does reach that kind of success in life.
Yeah, I know. That would probably, in some cases, make a kid not want to read at all.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen parents come into my school and say, you know, he doesn't know this. I said, but he will when I get done. I mean, I had a student that came in, he's in the fifth grade, he was 12, came from Jamaica, and walked in, didn't know me. He says, I heard that you're really good and you're going to teach me how to read. I don't know how to read any words. And I looked at him, and this is a group that came in at 6:30 in the morning. I said, by the end of the day, you'll be able to read something. And at the end of the year, he was reading on grade level, and the mother said, what did you do? I said, I didn't do anything. He did it. You know, if you want to learn, you can learn. And, you know, you just don't give up. So how does it change gears when you start part two? How did you start part two, and how is that different from how you started part one?
Go ahead, Lynn, part two.
Well, I mean, it just starts it goes back a little bit more in time. So part one is current action. And in part two, you have a lot of kind of flashbacks to when Daphne was younger and how everything started with her and Jackson. So I would say, you know, there's more back and forth. And also there's a point of view change. So part one is in the third person point of view through with a close filter through Amber. And in part two, we're in a first person in Daphne's mind, and everything is, you know, she's completely narrating the story. So you get a little bit of an even closer look, I think, inside that perspective.
Yeah, I know I have part two in front of me, and she's telling that she met Jackson when she was 26 and she finished graduate study. You see, people, I keep the book in front of me here. And she got a job, and the co-worker recommended that she get in touch with Parrish International. So what was her first impression when she met him? What did she think?
Well, she was impressed by the fact that she wasn't even expecting to meet with him because he's the head of the company. So she was surprised that he would take a personal interest. She was, you know, maybe a bit intimidated. She was younger. He's this powerful man, thought he was attractive, but she was trying to just really not think of him in that way because she was there on business and she's starting out this foundation. So he, you know, he sort of overwhelmed her to a degree, and things really got started much more quickly than she expected them to. You know, they moved forward more quickly than she originally intended. But he, you know, she was, his magnetic personality and the force of his will kind of took over.
So. I'm going to cross out these questions because it gives away too much. Tell us a little bit about Meredith. Yeah, I wrote them, and I'm saying I know I had a list that said Valerie Lynn whatever, but I said by the time I would find them on my 10,000 emails over here, let me just figure it out. Okay, so tell us about Meredith and why she's really pretty smart.
Go ahead, Val.
Liked her.
Who's going? Meredith. Meredith is. She's been around. She's seen it all. She's savvy. She's old money. And Daphne is her good friend. The others, the friendships are not that they're sort of not close friendships, but Meredith is really the one who is closest to Daphne. She cares about her, and she's mature. She's not one of the little gym girls who runs around in her short shorts, and as some of the others are. She's not impressed by lots of money. She's been around it for a long time. She's just more down to earth, and I think somebody who looks beyond just the exterior and wants to know what's going on inside. She's a wise person. And so she is a little more cautious when she's meeting new people, and especially somebody who her good friend, who she cares about, Daphne, takes under her wing. So I think it's more of a almost a protective sort of attitude that she has, looking out for her friend.
Well, tell us a little bit about – I'm changing questions so that I don't give anything away as I'm doing this.
Okay.
and I have the book in front of me. Her sister, Daphne's sister, was Julie. Tell us a little bit about her and why this organization meant so much to her, because Julie had cystic fibrosis. And there is no cure, is there, for that?
There
no.
is no cure. There are treatments. The treatments are they can be onerous. They're a cystic fibrosis patient can spend 5 hours a day just on things that they have to do to maintain their health and their body. I mean, they have to exercise. There are vests that they have to wear that sort of shake them to get rid of the mucus that builds up in their lungs. They're just it's a very, very difficult illness to live with. A disease to live with, and also it can hinder activities. So one of the things that Daphne made sure of was that she didn't listen to her friends who would say to her, "Just come on out, leave Julie at home." She was devoted to her sister, and that devotion and love is something that was a hallmark of their relationship, and her sister's death was devastating for her.
Yeah, I know how that feels. When I lost my sister, I feel like I lost the world. It was the hardest thing in the world, because she wasn't six. She had a massive heart attack. And I guess if her doctor the day before when he examined her had figured it out and gave her a stress test, maybe that would not have happened, but we don't really know. And unfortunately, the person that she was married to, it happened at 2:30 in the afternoon, never called me until 7 o'clock at night for whatever reason in his pathetic little mind. So when you did this book, did you do any research into criminal psychology or learning about people that have, you know, behavior problems?
Yes, a lot of reading on different personality disorders, and also, you know, research talking to a clinical psychologist and really, you know, authenticating the personality of Amber and others in the book.
And that is great, because when you know, I was lucky when I wrote my last book that I had a doctor that helped me, you know, to write the But it's hard to get law enforcement to help you, and it's hard to get psychologists. So actually, that's why I draw on all the nice authors that have professions that help me sometimes.
Right.
And if I'm lucky,
I have a good friend who's
an answer.
So
we have Daphne and Amber, and Daphne's children. How does Daphne's children really feel about Amber? If they could speak, what would they say about Amber at all?
They would say, we hate her, and we hope that she gets out of her lives. She's a horrible person.
Well, they're perceptive, and she tries to buy them, right? And a lot of people have been there, done it, know it, you know, want to buy the person, buy the kids. It didn't work. Maybe a little bit more with, you know, if you're nice to Bella, maybe. But Tallulah, you know, she's a sweet kid too. So Jackson and Amber, how do they connect or mesh? Or do they, or don't they really connect or mesh?
Well, Amber finagles a job working for him. So, I mean, that's, you know, again, her figuring out a way, you know, making it look like her boss at her other job sexually assaulted her, and so that gets Daphne to want to protect her. And so, you know, Amber begins to show Jackson how competent she is, and, you know, and she does something, you know, again, we won't go into too many things about what she does at the office, but she has a plan where she's going to make him depend on her. And then, as we said before, she slowly begins to become, you know, more attractive. So he starts, you know, he's with her every day, and you know, he is a man, and no matter how much he loves his wife, Amber, you know, Amber begins to become more and more attractive.
And Amber is smart. She's not. Amber isn't just this person with, oh, I'm going to just overwhelm him with sex appeal. Amber reads. She educates herself. In different circumstances, Amber could probably be a very nice woman who does the most with herself in terms of education, learning about art and music, but because of whatever in her past life, she's turned that on its head and is not using it for good. But as Lynn said, when she takes the job in his office, she's extremely competent, and she actually surprises him with some of the things that she institutes and some of the things that she comes up with when he's meeting with foreign visitors. So she's not just this little sex object. She's a bright, bright woman who has taken the time and effort to really educate herself and make herself more than what she was raised to be.
Yeah, she is kind of clever, and unfortunately, she could have used everything to her advantage and come out ahead.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Instead of doing what she did, which is, we won't say what she did, because she actually, I mean, there were other people in the office, and oh well. I got the feeling that if Amber didn't want you around, she stepped on you and got rid of you, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't care who you are. She's a great personality. And the sad part is that basically, no one really saw it until they, if they ever did. We won't say if they did. So, Daphne, I like Daphne. I like her in the second part. It's really, yeah. Well, so I started to read it, and I'm going like, wait a minute. The first part ended, and I won't say the last sentence of how it ended because I ripped out that question just now. And then in the second part, it's almost as if Daphne is somebody else, and she tells us about her past and her family and everything.
Mm.
So when does Daphne realize that her family might be in jeopardy or that things might be in jeopardy, or doesn't she realize that?
That's another one that's a little hard to talk to about without giving too much away, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Daphne could speak right now, what would she say that she might do differently, if at all? Well, what would she say about Amber?
I think she would say about Amber, some women get everything. Some women get everything they deserve.
And yeah, some people don't get what they deserve. But before I forget, yeah, and I have to search for the book for tomorrow, David McAuliffe will be here to talk about his new book, Reload, which he wanted me to have before it came out, so he printed it out for me. And thank God he printed it out in a font that Fran could read.
Nice.
Next, yeah, I can't, you know, I had a couple of books printed out, and I had to go to FedEx, and they love me over there, so even though there's a copyright, they reprinted the book so that I could read it in large print, because I looked at them and I said to my friend Kevin, please do this for me, and he didn't care. A week from Thursday, this is going to be a panel show. I love doing these. The one and only D.P. Lyle will be here to talk about how you present forensic evidence the right way when you write a novel, because I've read so many that are wrong. Detective Bruce Coffin will be here to talk about the police department.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Tabman will be here, what happens when the FBI takes over. And my favorite lawyer, Larry Thompson, who everybody knows from the Philip Fest. Larry was there. And he's going to be there to tell how you present it in court. And DP is really excited, and I'm going to be interviewing him on December 11th for his new book, A-List. He's phenomenal, and I'm, like, so excited.
He is, yeah.
Yeah, on the 14th,
what a great
panel. Marie. Yeah, it's good. I was like, I said, okay, let me see if they'll do this, and I'm going, okay, this is so cool. But I'm going to do some more in January because you never know when I'm going to contact people to do it. There's a book that I've read that was given to me by one of the publicists, and I was like, wasn't sure. It's called The Mean. The author's going to be on the show on November 16th. It's about high school and a real high school assistant principal and how he handled dealing with gangs. And the book is called It's phenomenal. It was fantastic. And, of course, I would be remiss if I didn't say, I have a few more in between, which I'll leave out, 12-6, John Land, Strong to Bone. You got to be there. The guy's great. And the book is better than ever. And if you don't know what to buy for Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa, get The Last Mrs. Parrish. Start buying them now so you get them all for all those people, for good stocking stuffers. To me, that's the best present in the world is a book.
Yeah.
So talk to us more about Bella and the birthday party. And I mean, I know there are kids in the world that believe that if it's my birthday, my sister's birthday, I want a present. Why does she have that mindset? By the way, my family does too. Sorry.
Lynn?
Well, I mean, for Bella, it's all about her. I mean, she really doesn't care. I mean, aside from the fact that, yes, she's driven by, she's got this reading disorder, she is also, and you know, has a huge narcissistic streak. And for her, she is bored by watching, you know, her sister open a bunch of presents. And because Jackson Depp is also a person who kind of showers all of them with material possessions, she's used to getting a lot of stuff. So to her, she's become very entitled due to, in part, her personality and in part because of the way that she's raised. So, she doesn't see any problem with demanding whatever she wants. And often she gets it.
Well, you know, there are a lot of kids like that. In my family, they believe that if one person gets a present, everybody has to get one too. And it has to be the same.
Oh, I like that.
I don't. Yeah, they do. As a matter of fact, but when my nephew graduated high school 100 years ago, I bought him a computer when my sister was around. And then when the second one graduated high school, my sister had just gotten sick, but she had sent me the check. And when the third one was my mission, my brother said, you are borrowing a computer. I go, I am? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you had to buy the same amount. And if you're giving $50 to one for Hanukkah or Christmas, everybody has to get the same amount. I guess it weighs it, so nobody thinks that they're more special. But sometimes,
that's right.
You know, the older guy gets a little extra in the envelope because he's been my partner in crime for life. So Daphne had a problem. After she had the children, she had a weight problem. So why was Jackson on top of her? Because she had a weight problem, and he didn't have any pity on her whatsoever. Why that?
Because, again, he wants his everything to be perfect, and, you know, you need to be a size 2 or less in Bishop's Harbor to do the country club scene.
And it's sort of like appearances only.
Well, she's a reflection of him. His wife is an appearance, is a reflection of him. His children, you know, they all reflect back on him, which is, you know, why he wants them to be in the best schools and have good grades and everybody to look perfect all the time. Yeah.
Sounds like somebody else I know. So how did the children really? Yeah, I know. My mother was a perfectionist. If you didn't hair, makeup, whatever, if it wasn't perfect, you did. I had to write it over. So he was not quite as bad though. How did the children really feel about him? Were they afraid of him? So I would be afraid of somebody like that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think they have a healthy respect for him. I think that, yeah, they definitely were more comfortable voicing their opinion to their mom. But again, I think that their household was the discipline structure predicated more on sort of a throwback to the traditional authoritarian style, and that's definitely what he is. So he could be a lot of fun. He could shower them with affection. You know, he would romp around with them in the pool and do fun things with them. But when he was serious, he was serious, and they knew that there was a line that they couldn't cross with him.
Well, I think there's a character that we could talk about without saying too much. Tell us about Douglas and how he came to work for Jackson.
You know, Amber wanted to make sure that there was not, when she wasn't working there anymore, she didn't want another attractive woman coming in and trying anything.
I don't
blame her. Hired Douglas. Yeah.
Right. Male, good looking, smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the key word being male.
I don't blame her. I don't blame her. I have to go with that.
Right.
One. I mean, she knows what she did. So she's preventing it from happening again. But that
absolutely
doesn't mean that if he went on a business meeting, that Jackson wouldn't stray anyway.
That's
so
true.
I mean, I mean, I wouldn't trust him as far as, I mean, knowing that she may get him, you know, and away from somebody else, what makes you think that somebody else can't get him away from you? This is what teenagers don't quite get. This is a really good book for teens to read, seriously. For young adults to see what happens when you have a friend that you think you can trust, and then you realize, oh well, and you know that judgment. So if Daphne could speak out right now, what would she say about her life? Would she change anything? Would she still be friends with Amber?
I think she would say, I have two beautiful daughters who are wonderful. I'm close to my whole existence now is to make sure that I raise these two girls to be good women, and I'm happy.
And what would Amber say if she can speak out? Would she go about it the same way?
That's the question again. We cannot answer because
right.
We give a spoiler.
she's a really interesting character. If somebody were to psychoanalyze her, I wonder what they would actually say as her personality.
Right. That would be interesting.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? And I'm not going to say anything more about what they actually find out about her or anything like that. But, I wonder if somebody would psychoanalyze her and if she would actually see, you know, when she's the person that does that, they don't think they're doing anything wrong. And they justify in their own minds, like, I want this person, and there's nothing that you can do about it. So, I mean, really, that's what's even scarier, that she felt that way. But I'm going to have one or two more questions. And, Bushwell, are you going to – my thought is that because Bella and Tallulah are younger, are you going to bring them back? to see how they turn out, or is this a standalone?
It's a standalone.
Right now, it's a standalone. Yeah, we have not thought about any sort of sequel or continuation of any of the characters at this point.
It'd be interesting to see what you could do with them if they turn out to be like, you know, which one they turn out to be like. It would be really fun to see if Bella turned out evil and Tallulah turned out to be good, and then they sort of go at each other. I love books like that. It's still around. It's just, my diabolical little mind going, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
yeah.
You separated. I know. It's like I said.
You can write that one.
No, I've written one of those. I've written one of those in my Birth of Fights backbook. Yeah. I know. My sister said to me, she's, you know, they used to make you write things over. If I didn't get 100 on a test, I had to write it over. I said, I'm telling you, Mom, like, you better than me. And then she actually, we're out on the flea market, and then she turned around to the lady and said, she was adopted. That's why she looks the way she does. Everybody's blonde, and then look at her. And I go, like, I knew I hated you. And I just laughed. But I used to wonder about that, too. Like, okay. If Jackson could say anything, what would he say about his life? Is he happy?
Well, again, that could be
wealth.
A little
wealth.
Bit of a spoiler, right?
No, I don't mean that. Yeah, I mean, he's probably, he sort of justifies himself that whatever I do is right and whatever I do is not right. And so what's next for both of you? What are you going to do next? Are you going to write another one together, or is this going to be another separate one? And tell us about the first one that I wrote, Elaine.
We're working on the next one. We're hard at work. Actually, when we hang up, we'll get back to that together. Another psychological thriller. And the one that I wrote before this, which I talked to you about last year, was The Veritas Deception, which is a conspiracy thriller.
I love that
thriller.
Book. That was right. So good.
Thank you. And that one potentially down the road could have, a follow-up book or two about that one. That's about the two journalists who are fighting a conspiracy, within the political and entertainment world. So.
I was hoping you were going to do a follow-up on that one. That would be really good. So when do you suppose that this next one's going to come out? And do you have a title? I'm terrible. I have to have it before.
We can't say the title yet, now, because we don't know if it'll change, right? So I'm not sure. We're hoping, but it'll depend on the publisher and everything. So, but I hope, we're hoping to finish it in the next 3 or 4 months, right, Val?
Oh, that's good. So you'll have it at the film fest. Are you guys going to come?
Excuse me.
Are you going to come to the film fest?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
We just registered. Mm-hmm.
We'll definitely
be
there.
I hope to be there. If John invites me, I will be there. I get this. He is absolutely the most amazing person on this planet, and he'll just send me books, and I won't even know I got it. And I interviewed him with he wrote a horror book, and I interviewed him with Fabrizio Bacardi, who wrote the horror with him. And oh my God, the book was fantastic. And interviewing two of them together was a riot. It was amazing. So John Lamb will be here, like I said, on December 6th to talk about Strong to the Bone. And if you haven't read it, this is the best one he's written for Caitlin Strong ever. It was absolutely fantastic. Oh, everything he writes is fantastic. But I can't wait to read your next one, and I hope I get it beforehand.
Thank you.
And for those of you that want to know my picks, I'm not telling. In December, I give the Just Reviews. I'm a sanctioned site. The Just Review Books of the Year awards will be given in December. I will talk to my publisher about creating the awards, because it's always good to do them professionally, because I don't even want to attempt to do something like that. And I want to thank you both for today. This was really fantastic. I enjoyed talking about it, and I'm glad I was able to question. I realized what I, not to ask and whatever. And I can't wait to see the next one in a couple of months.
Yeah.
And if it comes out, just let me know, and I'll be more than happy to read it before it comes out, because that's my most fun. Thank you so much, Fran.
It's been
everybody,
great talking to you.
Have a great time, and thank you so much, and bye.
Take care. Bye. Bye.